Hi, I'm Louise Crefield from Save Our Rights UK. We were founded in April 2020 and we have been fighting for our human rights to be upheld. We believe that we have them and they're inalienable, but they are not being upheld, as we've seen many times over the last 3 years. So our work and efforts go into getting those upheld as they ought to be.
Now, one of the obviously you've started up just as the pandemic started kicking in. What were you up to immediately? And what, do you feel that it was worthwhile?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started on the day that lockdown got extended, and that was the biggest human rights infringement at the time. And that hasn't been denied by anybody. Some people argue that it was justified. Others, as ourselves, argue that it was not, and actually it would cause more harm than good. So we were out on the streets from the 20th of April 2020, and that grew and grew and grew. And I would say it's definitely been worthwhile since our biggest protest, which was June 2021, which had nearly a million people on the streets. We've never been back in lockdown. And then back in February 2022, we managed to gathered together enough NHS workers to resist the mandates within the NHS, and we were out on the streets, and that got overturned at the 11th hour. So it was definitely worth it. And where they had to overturn the mandates for the NHS workers, it can never be rolled out and extended to the general public. So yeah, it was definitely worth it. It was lots of hard work, but definitely worth it.
What were the big highlights for you during that time? And, that you obviously had a massive demonstration. And I suppose the main question in a way is you've obviously learned a lot through this process. What do you think was really going on?
Well, that one is, it's the never ending question, because I would say a lot of the players that are involved, half of them don't even know what's really going on themselves. So different people have different motivations. But it's almost kind of irrelevant in lots of ways, I believe, because the reality is that our rights were infringed upon, and that should never happen regardless of what was going on. And so I like to focus on solutions, and I understand that different people have different takes. And I actually think different people in power have different takes on it, and nobody very, very few people really know what's going on.
I mean, I've heard a couple of good, I think, sort of almost summaries. One from a young lad just getting off the bus one day said, "Oh, it's a game, isn't it?" And and someone else saying it's a power grab. But where do you stand? Because I think we've got to surely understand the motivation behind this. Otherwise, it just looks like, just a kind of clique operating on their own. What do you think?
Well, my experience has been that any opportunity to garner more power will be taken. Some people believe that, it was manufactured to get more power. Others believe that it happened and then they utilized it to get more power. But the goal is always more power. And it's how much are we willing to give away before we stand up and say no more. And It's been a lot of the power that they've gained over the years has been very, very subtle. And obviously they've made nods to giving away power to appease the masses. For example, when Parliament first ever started, only gentlemen could vote. And then they expanded it to all men. And then they expanded it to women, But at the same time, mechanisms were put in place so that those votes were essentially meaningless. So,
well, they certainly seem to be more and more meaningless. Okay, so your work now, so you're looking at things like the digital ID, central bank digital currencies. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and this is why our organisation is called Save Our Rights UK. It was, it's about human rights, because I always knew that even once COVID and all of that was over, our human rights were still going to be under attack. And that is absolutely what we've seen. We had they tried to put through the Bill of Rights, but we managed to do a huge amount of pushback through putting out a guide to the consultation and tens of thousands of people responded to that, and that has now been scrapped. So that's wonderful.
Well, it sounds to me as if a Bill of Rights is exactly the sort of thing you wanted.
No, unfortunately not. The Bill of Rights was one of the most shocking pieces of legislation proposals that I've ever seen, because what it did in there, so it was going to scrap the whole Human Rights Act and replace it with the Bill of Rights. But one of the big caveats in the Bill of Rights was that all of our rights could be stripped away if it was in the interest of the greater good. Now, you could make an argument for pretty much anything, you know, to achieve that, you know, because you could make an argument that, I don't know, everybody's cars should be taken away from them for the greater good, or, you know, people with an IQ less than so-and-so should be sterilized. Well,
one thing that strikes me is they justify this a lot in security circles. For the greater good could mean saving the banks, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So all of our rights are in the Bill of Rights. It was going to be ratified into legislation that our rights were only ours unless it served the greater good, and that is a very dangerous game. So that is not something that we would ever want in legislation. Okay, and there were many other problems with it too.
Sorry, there was a lot of talk about this kind of vaccine ID scheme during the, I mean, in a way, I suppose there's been a sort of victory in a way, in that there was this kind of attempt to bring about a new normal, which doesn't really seem to have succeeded. But this whole idea of a digital ID, a vaccine ID, that seems to be still chugging along.
Yeah. And the problem is, it's one of those things that, again, it can be spun and sold in a way of convenience. And there is an element of, it would be really convenient to have all of our data combined in one place and that to be utilized really easily. That's like, I've not got a problem with advances in technology and making things more streamlined. However, the problem is we've got a government that we can't trust, that we know are power hungry, and there is no accountability, no transparency, and no mechanisms to challenge them if they use our data or control our data in a way that we're not happy with. So it's not like the notion of utilizing technology, not a bad thing, but in a way that gives these people even more power, absolutely not, because they've demonstrated they cannot be trusted and they do not have our best interests at heart.
I think you've summed that up quite well, because I mean, certainly most of the legislation passed in this country, there was always some kind of public interest defense. So for example, as the law is framed around a new topic, whatever that might be, I mean, I suppose we could even think about artificial intelligence at the moment, you know, laws surrounding that there must be absolutely cast iron guarantees that, for example, disclosures about it must be made in the public interest, and that people actually own their own data rather than whoever's running this digital ID. So what stage is that at now?
So they did a big consultation again. So it's funny, actually, they did a consultation, I think, back in 2018, 2019, but it wasn't advertised, and about 128 people or something responded and all went, yeah, we love the idea of digital ID. And then you look at who responded and it was like tech companies. So they ran another one and there was a lot of pushback. Again, we put out a guide for that. That's something that we do quite often at Save Our Rights UK, is put out guides for consultations. And so, again, they've had a lot of pushback, but they're still looking at it. And yeah, so we don't know where it's at. It's very much in a behind the scenes phase at the moment, where they're assessing what they can get away with, I think.
What about these central bank digital currencies? Very much in the news at the moment, and some discussion about this idea of programmable money. All seems to be sort of migrating towards the sort of Chinese social credit system, whereby, I mean, you talked about convenience just now. I think it's quite funny, isn't it? You know, it's obviously, if you're just waving a card to pay, can be very convenient. But then it's not convenient. Say if you're waving your mobile phone and the battery's run out, you know, it doesn't work. And also, of course, sometimes computer says no, doesn't it? And so these central bank digital currencies, can you just tell us a bit about those and the programmable, you know, the idea that them being programmable and where we are with that?
Yeah, so again, it's that thing of, you know, you see in Sweden, even some people have got chips in their hands so they can just pay with their hand. But in places like Taiwan and stuff, whenever there's a big cyclone storm coming in, the first thing everybody does is run to the cash point so they've got cash so that they can still get materials that they need because they know all the power is about to go out. And, you know, as soon as you're dependent on electricity, the national grid, which we hear in the news is apparently not able to supply enough electricity to us all, you know, it's a dangerous game. And central bank digital currency doesn't have a cash option. And if you read, if you read the papers that they've put out, they are saying that they're not going to have it technically as programmable by the Bank of England, aren't going to program it, but the option is there for anybody who utilizes it. So the Bank of England are absolving themselves because they're not the ones doing the programming, but people who utilize it, so say if HSBC decides to use it or another bank decides to use it.
Well, look, I don't know about you, but I haven't got an account at the Bank of England.
No, me neither.
obviously, you know, the private banks can do what they want with this. So, I mean, there's just been a big consultation about it. I think it's just closed, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, again, we put out a guide for that. And, and over 50,000 people responded to it, which was amazing. They weren't. And again, they run these the reason they run these consultations is because that's what you have to do if you live in a democratic society. But what they don't want is actually anybody to respond to them. And what they then do is they take silence as consent. So it is really important to take part in these consultations, even if you think it's not going to make a difference. But at least then we can evidence that we said no. Whereas if we say nothing, then we don't really have an argument. So it's important to always take the time. And that's why we make these guides, because then it makes it really quick and easy for people to take part in it. Because it's not worth our collective time and effort for us all to figure out these awful consultations, because they are always worded in such a way that they're really hard work to get through. So we make it as easy as possible, but it is important to do them nonetheless. But they weren't expecting as much pushback as they got, because I think they got 50,000 responses and they were all negative.
So is cash going to survive through this?
We're going to have to work for it. And again, we've actually got some campaigning coming up on this in an angle that, because lots of people are talking about keeping cash campaigns. You know, there's quite a few big names talking about it, but we've identified an angle that nobody else has actually utilized yet. And actually this is an angle which we can leverage to force organizations and shops and businesses that are only accepting card back into forcing cash legally. So we're going to have that out shortly in the next week or two, I should imagine. So definitely keep an eye out for that. That should be quite good.
Yeah, there's a lot of places out there, particularly the chains and restaurants and places like that, who are just refusing to take cash. I just wondered, is that legal? Because, I've seen people, and in fact, I've been sitting with people who turn up when it comes to paying the bill. They say, oh, well, we've only got cash. And, of course, they will accept cash. They're not going to call the police because you insist on paying in cash. So what's the legal position?
So this is the issue. So the legally they can do that, and they at the same time you also have the legal right to pay in cash. You know, you're offering legal tender for a service, you're not refusing to pay. So but what you might not get is you might not get change. That's part of the issue, is if they don't have a float, if they're not geared up for accepting cash, they might not actually be able to give change. So it can be quite difficult, because if it's like £42 and you've only got £50 in cash, that's quite a lot of money that you'd lose. by paying.
Well, you could see it. You could see it as a tip. But anyway, I mean, what we're seeing here is really that they're lying when they say they won't accept cash, because they will if their arm is twisted a bit.
Absolutely. They just don't want to, because, and again, part of the issue here is back in the day, it used to be cheaper to use cash, because like when credit card machines came out and everything, they had to pay quite a bit to process card transactions. Do you remember how often it was like you have to have a minimum of £5 spend to use your card because the fees are so high and things like that? They didn't actually. Whereas it's now flipped, and it actually costs many businesses more to process cash than it does to process cards. So, and also because so many banks have shut down, it's really difficult to get into a bank and to deposit money and to get floats. And so basically it's becoming, they're making it very difficult for businesses to use cash. It's not even just the businesses being contrary.
Yeah,
the banks are making it very difficult for them.
That's right. I mean, this is an arbitrary decision made by the banks. There's been no kind of consultation. There's been no government intervention. Just as an aside, I was over recently at the Bilderberg meeting in Lisbon. And by the way, the Bilderbergers have got about 150 of them were very much involved in the pandemic. There's a great page on WikiSpooks going through all the Bilderberg members at the different stages, the propaganda stages, the scientific stages, the policy making stages, the lockdowns, who were very much involved in the pandemic. But over there, it's a different culture, Louise. It's just, well, nobody... Very few people want to take electronic money. They all want to take cash, even in the big cities like Lisbon.
Yeah, and that's just, again, it's that thing, though, here in the UK, we have, you know, such high costs of living that people are overworked and under-resourced. And people just don't even have the time to go get cash out. They don't. And, you know, you've got most families have got two parents who are having to work full time just to make ends meet. You know, we've got interest, and people are just exhausted. But my belief is they're kept in that state of exhaustion, of overwork and under resource. So they just don't even have the mental capacity to look at the state of the nation and to do anything about it. Mm. Because, yeah, they don't have extra time and resource to do so. And that's the best way to, you know, keep it, because it's that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, you need security, you need shelter, you need food. And for most people in the UK, that is under threat most of the time, because they're like living paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, they can't afford to be sick even. They can't afford to take a day off. And if you can't afford to miss a week of work, how can you really take time and energy to put into challenging the government on all the things that they're doing? You can't. So it's a very good way to keep everyone compliant.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And in fear, I suppose, as well. Now, I know you're also working on home education. I wasn't aware that there were changes to that, because I know, for example, we've seen some horrific things going on in our schools with teachers and other individuals in the schools encouraging teenagers to maybe discard the sex they were born with and choose their own sex, choose their own new name, not given to them by their parents, this kind of thing. So there are quite a lot of parents out there who are not happy about handing their kids over every day to these, well, you might call wokist, but certainly some individuals that they would not wish to have access to their children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also the education system, the state education system, isn't fit for purpose anyway. You know, we expect four-year-olds to go to school for five full days. Four-year-olds are babies, and you're expecting them to do five full days of formal learning. And it's a nonsense. And it actually... hinders literacy rates. You know, everywhere else on the continent doesn't start till seven, and that is proven scientifically to serve children better to not start formal education until seven. And that's what my children do. My children don't go to a state school, and it works. And, you know, the science proves it. And, you know, I'm not often a big fan of the science because we know how it can be manipulated and stuff. But actually on this one, you know, but the problem is our government, for some reason on this, are ignoring the science. And so, you know, and it, schools are bright lights, strip lighting, conformist, everyone has to wear the same clothes, everyone has to, you know, they don't serve our children, and they do not create well-rounded, happy adults by the end of it. And lots of people have recognized that, and actually they realized how much their children were suffering at school, mentally and emotionally. And during the pandemic, they were all out of school, and actually I think they saw how much their children thrived. So lots of them have kept them off, and that's amazing. What a gift to those children to have that extra time with their parents. And yeah, but now home education is under threat because so many people are making that move, and those children won't be as compliant. And yeah, and that's not ideal for people.
What are the government up to around home education then? I can't even remember, sorry to say this, but I can't even remember who the education secretary is these days. We seem to have so many changes.
Do you know what? I can't either, actually. I can't think of who it is. But yeah, so no, at the moment, so what they're looking to do is basically introduce a centralized register and put in lots more formal checks. So everybody who's home educated will have to go on this centralized register. Now, technically, if they added all the data up from all the different sources, they could figure out everybody who's on it. But they want to force everyone to sign onto these things and then also do lots of work, basically justifying themselves to the local education authorities in each city. And the thing is, you know, again, there's been consultations on this, and every single time, parents and children have responded and said, we do not want this, we do not need this. But they don't like it because they don't like uncontrollable people. So they're really working hard at, and there's another consultation actually coming up, which we're about to release a guide to, because of the government, it's a consultation about the children that haven't returned to school since COVID.
So I've looked her up. The education secretary is somebody called Gillian Keegan. I don't think I've ever seen her ever, you know, just talking very much about anything. I think it's a fascinating topic. We could talk for hours about it. But I mean, I was lucky enough to go to a grammar school aged 11, the 11 plus. There's a bit of a contention about this whole idea of whether it's a good idea to split kids of different abilities, and maybe some who are more practically minded, others who are more physical, maybe sporty minded, others who are you know, big readers, intellectual, up into different groups at that age. What do you think about that? Because I remember back in the 1970s it was what was her name, Shirley Williams, that's right, who ended the whole grammar school system. And that was a system which was set up after the Second World War in the Butler Report to give bright kids from poorer backgrounds anyway an education which was up to scratch with the public schools. And in fact, the Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, the last but one, his father was a railway porter, you know. Yeah. And he managed to get into a grammar school, and he eventually became governor of the Bank of England, amazingly. He's the one who's warning about the massive multi-trillion pound debt overhang, and he's still warning, but no one's really listening to him anymore. So anyway, what do you make of, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a nice idea to be able to home educate kids, and then they get some sort of association, which they really need as children, with other kids. But what about, you know, fixing the state education system? Because I think we also need to sort of shine a light on that too.
Absolutely. So as I say, my children don't go to a state school. They go to what's called a Steiner school. And they go there from when they're 3 till they're 16 in the same school. And Steiner was writing about all the stuff that's going on today over 100 years ago. And Steiner schools really serve the children. So, you know, there's no testing, there's no uniforms. They still use blackboards and wooden desks and stuff. But where the teachers are so in tune with the children, they know each of the children so deeply because they actually have the same teacher from when they're 6 till they're 14. And that teacher, so they all get different work set within the same classroom. And each one is challenged at their own level. But they're within a mixed classroom. So it's, and they, what they teach there is, and what, no, not that they teach, what they foster is self-motivation and a love of learning. And it's phenomenal to watch because I know for me, state education killed my love of learning. And it didn't foster self-motivation either. Whereas, yeah, so there is definitely ways to make schools work. Because for me, I've got 4 children, and home education would be a real challenge for me, as much as I like the romantic notion of it. But for me, it's better for them to be in school. But there are schools that can and do work and serve the children. And yeah, and that is absolutely a possibility, and it ought to be done, because not everybody is equipped and able to home educate, and that shouldn't necessarily be the one blanket option. Schools are a great thing, so there's definitely ways of making schools work, but not the way it currently is.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't personalize this really, but you are a bit younger than me, and I think there were some massive changes around, well, in the late 1970s in the way that education worked, because certainly where I was, you know, we loved learning, and also we were challenged all the time by other bright kids to, you know, it was a bit of a race really, and it was fun. It was almost like running a sports race, but in an intellectual way, with all the kids around you sitting next to you, or, you know, and everyone kind of helped everyone else along at the grammar schools. Anyway, one of the reasons we're talking to you this week is because you're another one like Debbie Hicks, like Nigel Farage, and I'm sure there are many, many, many more, Louise, who've had problems with their bank, really apparently singling them out. So what's happened with you?
So what happened with me is, so obviously Save Our Rights UK got a bank account. We set up a business bank account, which was running fine. You know, there's no debt with our business. We have low overheads. We survive on generous donations of people. And we've always just had enough. We don't have lots of money. We don't have, but we don't have debt either. And so our business account was just ticking along just fine. And then back in May 2021, I had my first court appearance, because I've been charged over the years for organizing protests. I've been charged 8 times and been found guilty 5 times. But on the first court appearance, it was just a plea hearing. So we went to court and I pleaded not guilty. So, you know, in theory, innocent until proven guilty. And so at that point, you couldn't say, yes, I'd committed a crime or not. But I got home that night and I had an email from our business bank account saying, we're closing your account, from on the day that I was first in court.
Can I ask you which bank it was?
So that was actually with a bank called Cash Plus, which had really good business rates. And ever since then... So I was like, oh, okay. So I tried to open another business bank account because like I say, because we've got quite a low turnover. Some of the business bank accounts weren't suitable or had really high fees that we didn't want to be paying.
Right, yeah.
So it's why we'd gone for cash.
They do tend to, you know, punish smaller businesses, and it's benefits these massive multinationals and chains, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So we went on a hunt trying to find other business bank accounts. And we just kept getting rejected after rejected after rejected. And I asked one of them, I was like, why are we getting rejected? And they said, well, we do 2 checks. So we do a credit check. And then there's another check. And for the life of me, I can't remember what it's called. But basically, it's a kind of a risk assessment check. And he said that we basically been blacklisted on the risk assessment check. But he couldn't tell me why. But we were on the blacklist of the other risk assessment check. I can only imagine, because we were in court and we were standing up for human rights and we were saying things and stuff. And ever since then, we've never been able to get Save Our Rights of Business account. So we had to use, I had another business at the time, which happened to have two accounts. So we decided to separate it out and just use one for that business and use the spare one for Save Our Rights. And then that had to go. And then I had to use another account, which then had to go. And then I was been using a personal, like a spare personal account, because all this time I've been trying to get a business account for Save Our Rights and not been able to. So recently I put it in, I opened just like a spare current account with the co-op. And yes, you're not meant to use business, put business stuff through it. I understand that. But what else can I do when I've got a business and I can't open a single bank account for it? And so I was running it through this current account, and then they realized that I was running a business through it. And so they said they were going to close it, but I'm in the exact same situation. I then applied to the co-op again, and I got the notice yesterday that they're declining me opening a business account, even though they've just seen the money and the fact that there's no debt and that it works. They're just like, nope. So I've had to move it to another, I've had to open another personal account. I've had to put the money in there, knowing that probably in a few months they'll close that again too. And I'll end up not even being able to open personal accounts. So it's actually going to impinge on my ability to get bank accounts as well, because I'm going to end up having all these bank accounts that get closed, which is not good for me and my records. But I don't know what else I'm meant to do.
Well, I mean, it might be a kind of little message there to try and persuade you to stop your business and stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because eventually I'll run out of bank accounts. Eventually I will. At the moment, I'm like moving through random personal accounts that I have to keep starting, but they'll only ever last a few months. So,
I mean, one of the most interesting things you've said there is this check that they do. It sounds to me as if it's some kind of political check, actually, that that people with certain political views, activists, will be flagged up on there and refused a bank account.
Yep, that's basically what I was told. Yeah.
So anyway,
we're on the blacklist.
I mean, it's very much like, sounds to me very much like, you know, when you're on a blacklist, you don't know about, if you're on a blacklist, that database you should have access to.
Mm-hmm.
So I would at least advise you to, I don't want to be patronizing, but to do some sort of FOI request or a data protection request to find out what's on there. And also I think just let everybody know that this is going on, because quite clearly the banks are not telling people that this is happening. They're just closing accounts or refusing without actually letting people know why they're being refused. Anyway, what about your group, your campaign? Can people still actually donate now you're having these bank accounts closed down?
Yeah, they can still donate, because and like I say, we've moved to another account, it'll probably end the last few months, but till then we can use the money, and we're really grateful for all donations that we receive. But and it keeps us ticking along and doing the bits that we're doing. But so people can keep donating. But again, this just highlights why we can't risk moving fully over to CBDCs, because then they can do all this sort of stuff. And so, yeah, it was interesting timing along with the CBDC campaign. It's like, yeah, this is why we can't just have something that the banks have control of, because they're clearly not to be trusted.
What do you make about what happened to Nigel Farage?
Well, yeah, like it's been happening. Like I say, this first happened to us actually in 2021. That was actually the crunch point for us. But right, it happened, like I say, when I was in and out of court, and also we had May and June 2021 were our biggest protests, and I had the Met Police trying to arrest me and things. So it kind of just, it didn't get, I just kind of got on with it at the time and didn't make any fuss about it because I had so much else going on. And it's almost just become our normal. And I think it's the same case. It's interesting now because we're hearing all these stories coming out. so many people have just kind of gone, yeah, that's what they do. Yeah, they're that corrupt. Yes, they do control everything.
Yeah, and there isn't really any voice in Parliament, it doesn't seem to me, speaking out against this at all. No opposition, I mean, certainly from Labour, but even within the Conservative Party, which has been the only opposition over the last 3 or 4 years, since the Jeremy Corbyn era, almost nothing. So, look, where can people find your site and you know, get hold of your briefings, that sort of thing, and support you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you go to saveourrights.uk, you can join up on the mailing list. And so we send everything out by mail. But obviously, we're also on all social media platforms under Save Our Rights UK. But algorithms can be a bit temperamental. Whereas if you're on the mailing list, you will definitely get it to your inbox. So you won't miss anything.
Okay, Louise Cressfield, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.